Too bad I have to talk, huh? Nice to sit together, and nothing needs to be said, but I would like to talk about a Zen story this evening. There's a famous collection of stories called the Book of Serenity. It has 100 Zen stories in it, and every story has a little introduction, and then the story, and there's a poem that goes with the story, and then over the generations, there's commentary. So I'm going to start with the introduction to the story. The name of the story is Dasui's Aeonic Fire, and it's the 30th of the 100 cases of the Book of Serenity. So here's the introduction. Obliterating all opposites and relativities. Cutting off all doubt. What phrase can we use? The capital is not an inch of a step away. And the greatest mountain only weighs 3 pounds. But tell me, on what principle do you stand to see it like this? So these little introductions are meant to be sort of provocative clues as to what's coming in the story, giving you a sense of what's at stake in the story to follow. And to open you up to the challenges that the story poses. So here we're being told that if you can really appreciate the story that I'm going to tell you in a moment, if you can sit with it and really chew on it and penetrate it, not try to figure it out intellectually, but really immerse yourself in it and become the story with your whole heart and your whole body and soul, then this story will free you from your various oppositions and dualities. In other words, it will free you from your ordinary, fearful ways of thinking about and conceiving of ourselves in the world. We usually think that our goals and ideals are far away, and we generally punish ourselves for not having realized them. But as we just heard, our goals and desires, our true desires and goals and ideals, are not far away. They're actually right here. You're already awakened right now. We all think we have very weighty problems, but we just heard that actually our problems are not weighty at all. They're light as a feather. Now, to be clear, it's not that our goals and ideals as we dualistically conceive of them are actually right here, or that our human problems as we dualistically conceive of them are light and not heavy. It's that the normal notion of who we think we are and what we think we're doing in a world we think we understand is pretty much wrong. And once we can feel our lives past that notion, then we can be relieved of our burdens. Then it would be possible just to live with confidence with a loving heart, no matter what happens. And all our doubts would come to an end. Because we would know. We would know for sure, even if we don't know what we know or how we know. We would know somehow how to be ourselves and how to live. So this is what the little introduction to the case is telling us. That's what it's saying, using kind of Zen, blustery, metaphorical language. Okay. Now with that build-up, you're ready to hear the story, right? So here's the story. Once a monk asked Dasui, "When the fire at the end of an eon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not?" And Dasui said, "Destroyed." The monk said, "Then it goes along with that?" And Dasui said, "Yes, it goes along with that." And the "this" and the "it," you know, in the, that he's talking about, refers to ultimate truth, ultimate awakening. So is this destroyed when the universe is burned up? Yes, this is destroyed. A monk asked Longzhi, "When the fire-ending eon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not?" And Longzhi said, "Not destroyed." And the monk said, "Why is it not destroyed?" And Longzhi said, "Because it's the same as the universe." So that's the story I'm going to talk about. So we seem to be talking about the end of the world, the fire that rages through and destroys an entire world system. And this resonates for our moment when there are, let's be honest, so many fears about our collective future. We seem on many fronts to be facing some pretty serious limits. And it's pretty scary. I think that we try not to think about it, but actually, it's pretty scary. And we may think that humanity has never before faced a moment like this, and maybe that's true. But I think that at other times in history, people certainly thought, believed, as far as they knew, that they were facing the end of the world. And just like now, people then did all kinds of crazy things in response to these fears. During the Black Plague in Europe, pretty much every third person perished for no reason that anyone could understand. Can you imagine that? Every third person, imagine this room, every third person is dead. And nobody had any idea why, other than the collective sins of humanity, which is what they believed was the cause of this. Or maybe at the time of the demise of the Mayan civilization, when very mysteriously, and nobody really knows how, everything came to a sudden halt just at the time when the cycle of cosmic time in their calendar ended. So there were other times and other civilizations in which the end of the world seemed close at hand. But now we think we have much better information than they had then. So this time, it's really serious. Which perhaps is true. Or maybe 100 years from now, when we have still better information, we will look back at the fears we have now and consider them foolish, because then we'll say, now we really have something to worry about. Who knows? I certainly don't know. But this story is reminding us that in ancient Buddhist cosmology, which conceived of many worlds and many worlds as systems, the end of a world and the end of many worlds was considered an ordinary, everyday inevitability. Universes were destroyed all the time, giving way to new universes. So in our story, the monk is inquiring, assuming that worlds are destroyed, and wondering whether that in which he has ultimate faith, what he calls this, maybe somebody in Europe would have called it God, would that be destroyed when the whole universe is destroyed? And Dasui very harshly and succinctly simply says, yes, it will be destroyed. Nothing lasts. Everything must go, as they used to say, big posters on stores at liquidation sales, you know, everything must go. Then later, the same question is asked again of some other Zen master, and he answers in the opposite way. No, this will not be destroyed. Why? Because this is the same as the universe, which is destroyed. Which, of course, doesn't make any sense according to the way we usually understand things. So, when you read this story, it gets you annoyed. It gives you many problems. It's casting doubt on our idea of the world. If there is a world, there must be something beyond the world, which is called this, or God, or something. But no, this and the world are not different, which means that the world and what's beyond the world are not different. So what is the world? This would not be the world we think we know. And the story also casts doubt on the difference between being destroyed and not being destroyed. That's what Longji is clearly saying. He's saying this is not destroyed because it is destroyed, which also makes no sense to us. Unless, of course, the way we usually make sense doesn't make sense. And then on top of all of these problems, we have the problem of two Zen masters seeming to contradict one another, which also casts some doubt on the reliability of Zen, which maybe these monks have been depending on. And now they can really doubt whether it makes any sense at all. So let's sit for a moment with these stories and let's make them personal, as we always do in our practice. So let's find our meditation posture just for a few moments. And the way we can do this, this is how we practice in Zen sometimes. We sit with one of these stories and we make it personal. And we do that by contemplating a phrase from the story, not thinking it through, but just bringing it into our breath, into our body, and sitting in the present moment, breathing into the story and seeing how it influences us. So let's start for a few breaths with meditating on it like this. My life is beyond my life. My life, this life that I am living every day, is beyond itself. My life is beyond my life. And here's another way we can practice with this story. My life will end. It will never end. My life will end. It will never end. So you can imagine practicing like that with this story for maybe 10 years. What that would be like, you can imagine. It would probably have an impact on the way you view your life and understand your death. So I mentioned that there's always a commentary to these stories by another Zen teacher, Wansong. And in this case, I want to read you a paragraph from his commentary because it's kind of interesting. It's a little wacky, but it's, when you think about it, it's really interesting. He's telling you, where does this phrase come from? You know, the original phrase in the story, in the raging of the aeonic fire, the whole universe is destroyed. Where does that phrase come from? So here's what he says about that. He says, when the fire at the end of an eon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? This question originally comes from the scripture on the benevolent king safeguarding the nation. And here's the situation that's told in that sutra. Once upon a time, there was a king, Kalmashapada, who, believing in the words of the non-Buddhist pundit Ratta, who advised him to this effect, he decided that he would behead 1,000 kings and offer them in a graveyard to the god Mahakala, the great black one, hoping to prolong the fortune of his nation. So he went to this sage and said, how can I, you know, preserve the fortunes of my nation? And the sage said, behead 1,000 kings and make an offering to Mahakala. And he said, okay, makes sense. So he went ahead and organized this. One of the kings that was to be beheaded, King Samantaloka, said, well, all right, but can I have one more day before this takes place so that I can provide a meal for 100 Dharma teachers, because this is very good karma, and if I'm going to lose my life, I want to have a good beneficial act at the last. And so King Kalmashapati said, okay, you can have that day. And at that banquet for the 100 Dharma teachers, the first Dharma teacher spoke a verse for the king, and the verse was in the raging fire of the Aeonic. That's where the verse comes from. And the whole thing, that's just the first line, the whole thing is 32 lines. And so this king, Samantaloka, was really impressed with this 30-line poem and began reciting it as he was on his way to be executed. And King Kalmashapata heard this, and it struck him. And immediately when he heard this verse, his mind opened to understanding. He stopped the execution, gave up being the king, gave the kingship to his brother, and became a monk, and then became awakened because of this verse. So I thought you would appreciate that story. It's a good story. Now, it sounds outrageous, you know, when you hear it, but if you think about it for a while, it actually is very contemporary. King Kalmashapata wants to preserve his reign. He is by no means resigned to the fact that his kingdom won't last forever. He wants it to last for a really, really long time, and he wants to know what needs to be done in order to make that happen. So he takes some non-Buddhist advice. We're told carefully that it's non-Buddhist advice, which is to sacrifice all these kings. This will surely work. Well, it sounds ridiculous, but actually, when you think about it, this is not too far removed from what we're doing, right? To preserve the nation, let's kill a whole lot of people who are threatening the nation. Let's drop bombs on them, or send drones to blow them up, or send soldiers. This will work. Right? It is common political discourse in all parties to say that we have a great nation, the greatest nation ever, and that it must be preserved at all costs. You can't say anything other than this and you get elected to be dog catcher. So we go out and get some good non-Buddhist advice, which tells us what to do to keep our nation going. Protect our borders. Keep out immigrants. Surveil the entire population 24/7. Spy on the entire world. This'll work. Can you imagine a politician saying, well, the United States of America is a couple of hundred years old, and it hasn't worked out that perfectly, really, and probably it won't last that much longer. Can you imagine a politician saying that? No, you can't. Because you cannot say that. You cannot even think that. So this is pretty much what King Kalmashapati in the story is saying. Preserve the nation, do what it takes. But then one of his victims, King Samantaloka, convenes a Buddhist assembly and gets some teaching, and King Kalmashapata happens to hear this teaching, and it completely turns him around. He completely, in a moment, gives up all his destructive ways that he had been practicing in the name of preserving the nation. And all of a sudden, he becomes peaceful. He goes beyond preservation and violence. He goes beyond nations. He goes beyond power. Because he heard this teaching. And what was the teaching? In the raging of the aeonic fire, the whole universe is destroyed. And what is that? That's a teaching of radical impermanence. It's a teaching that if you really and truly take it in and absorb it, will make you peaceful and loving. And it is the essence of Buddha Dharma. Buddha Dharma really amounts to nothing more than that. Impermanence. Nothing lasts. Everything passes. And by virtue of that, we are all in this together. In other words, impermanence, if you really understand it and follow its full implications, is love. When you are on a sinking ship, as we all are, certainly, you don't want to be fighting with all the other passengers on board. That would make it really much worse. You want to be hugging and kissing everybody as the ship goes down. It can be a beautiful moment. You know, you can have a champagne toast. But actually, there's more to this story. The next sentence of Wan Song's commentary reads as follows. In the teachings, it says that thousands of thousands of thousands of universes become and disintegrate as one at the same time. So this is the great Mahayana Buddhist teaching about impermanence. What do we think impermanence means? We think impermanence means that things exist for a while and then they don't. Right? Isn't that what we think? We're here now, but later we won't be. Everything appears and later it'll be gone. That's impermanence. And that is the sad sinking boat. The sinking boat of our lives and the sinking boat of our poor world that can't last. But actually, it's not really like that. That's just a conventional and surface understanding. In fact, as the commentary says, all universes arise and cease as one on every moment of time. And this keeps happening every moment of time. So the Mahayana Buddhist teaching about impermanence is that impermanence is permanence. Permanence, of course, is absolutely impossible. It's an idea, a concept that exists because there's a concept of impermanence. In other words, both impermanence and permanence are ideas. They are not realities. They're concepts that we hold. Both of them are inherently self-contradictory when you truly examine them. As are all our ideas about ourselves and our lives and the world, which are based on these fundamentally flawed concepts that are so ingrained in our way of thinking and in our language that we can't see past them. And this is why Zen stories have such a bad reputation for being so paradoxical, because they refuse to accept those assumptions. They always challenge them. And they're doing this not to be jokey or tricky or, you know, thumbing their nose at us or something. They're doing it because our basic ideas really don't make any sense. The closer you look, the more self-contradictory they are. And that's what the story, the main story, is demonstrating. There doesn't need to be anything beyond the world, because the world is already beyond the world. There doesn't need to be anything beyond your life, because your life is already beyond your life. There doesn't need to be some permanence, because permanence is right here in the middle of impermanence. Now, I realize this sounds weird, you know, when I say it, but it's not weird. It's the way things are. When we have these concepts of permanence and impermanence, what happens? We're afraid. We become like King Kamashapada, desperately trying to shore up what basically can't be shored up. It's a losing battle. Desperately trying to fix what is already perfectly fixed in its brokenness. The consequence of appreciating and settling in with this story is that we don't have to act out of our fear anymore. Our doubt can be set to rest, and we can recognize that the conceptual frameworks necessarily underlying our lives are just exactly that. They're conceptual frameworks, not substantial realities. And this makes a big difference. Knowing that the ways we commonly think and think about and look at the world are just ways of looking and thinking, and not the way the world is, to know that makes a big difference in the way you think and live and feel. So when our commonly held ideas cause us to be fearful, cause us to be despairing, we have the ability to think and feel past them. It's not that we're going to get the right perspective. The story is not offering us a better perspective. It's just reminding us that the perspective we have isn't right. It can't be, we can't hold on to it. Holding on to the perspective we have is causing us a lot of suffering and fear. So practically speaking, what does this mean for our actual life and practice? It means that when we feel fear and despair and desperation, instead of believing in its conclusions, we will study the actual mechanism of fear and desperation and despair, and challenge that mechanism. And remember that actually we don't know. We really don't know what this world is. We really, really don't know what our lives are. We really, really don't know what's happening to us right now. We don't know. And we don't know what's going to happen. And we're not supposed to know. We can't know. We're not built to know. And that's our practice. Sitting in the middle of this beautiful, challenging question that is my life and your life and our collective life together. And of course, I'm thinking of our present moment, our present political crisis all around the world, our environmental crisis, all the catastrophes that we're living through right now. King Kalmashapata is raging on, destroying people and pouring carbon into the atmosphere at an insane rate. What we're doing every day is not all that different from beheading 1,000 kings. In fact, it's probably a lot worse. And from a human point of view, it makes a lot of sense to be upset about this and to get active in whatever way we can, as I'm sure so many of you are already. We really need huge changes in our economic system, our political system, the technologies that run our world. No wonder businesses and governments resist this change, because it's really a lot of work to turn this around. It's very inconvenient to business as usual. No wonder there's so many broken people running around in our world doing crazy things. Why would we be shocked or surprised? There will be upheavals. We will have to change the arrangements. We will have to have real compassion and real economic equality. We're really going to have to stop having racism and sexism and homophobia. We can't afford to do this anymore. It's a luxury that we can't afford as human beings. I think everybody's scared, and nobody really knows what to do. Nobody has the answer. But we do have great confidence and great faith. Not in a particular plan or a particular leader. What we have faith in is the collective process of living and dying itself that is built into our bodies and hearts. We do have faith and confidence that just by our continuing to stay active and stay involved and stay present and stay open-hearted and compassionate, we are together definitely going to go forth into some future, and nobody knows what that future is going to look like. But whatever it is, we know that we can go into it hugging and kissing, and that's going to be brilliant. So honestly, our practice gives us a tremendous faith. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't say, because I practice, I'm guaranteeing you that such and so will never happen. No, we don't know what will happen. But we do know that devotion to our practice and to open-hearted compassion and to the courage to act on that compassion will be fine. One way or another will be fine. So I pray every day for all of us and for our world. And I'm praying that we'll find out what to do, or somehow be driven to be finding out what to do. So this praying is good for me. It makes me happy and confident, and I recommend it to you to pray every day. I'm praying every day that things will be really good, that things will turn out okay. I'm not saying that praying is the answer to everything. I'm saying that that's just a good thing to do. I have lots of faith that this will not be destroyed, ever, because this is always destroyed, moment after moment after moment after moment, and that's why it can never be destroyed. So I'm going to read you one more section of Wansong's commentary because this is really wonderful to me. He tells a story, another story in this connection. He says, when Emperor Wu of the Han Dynasty excavated a lake, at the bottom of the lake he found ashes. And he couldn't understand why there were ashes at the bottom of the lake, so he called in a great sage and said, how come there are ashes at the bottom of the lake? And the sage said, well, you better ask somebody from India. They're smarter than we are here in China. So finally, somebody came from India sometime later, and he asked the sage from India, what about these ashes? And here's what the sage from India said. These are the ashes of a burned up eon. And he asked them, when the Holocaust happens and the world is emptied and burned up, where do the ashes go? And nobody could answer this. However, in the Cessation and Contemplation Sutra, it says, the arhats are like charcoal. The pratyekabuddhas are like ashes. Bodhisattvas are like the little bits of leftover ash, pulverized and almost insubstantial. And the Buddhas themselves are the aeonic fire, where there's no charcoal and no ash at all. So, this is really wonderful. Buddhas and bodhisattvas are the ashes of the burned up world that we're so afraid of losing. The worst has already happened. The world was destroyed long ago. All the worlds have been destroyed. And our lives right now are the ash. And of course, as we all know, this is literally the case. Just like Crosby, Stills, and Nash sang long ago, you know, we are stardust, right? Joni Mitchell also sang, we are stardust. We are, right? We all know this. We're stardust. We are what happened when the world was destroyed. What happened when the world was destroyed? We appeared. Isn't that wonderful? The end of the world already happened, and here we are as a result of that. Think about this, folks. You are carrying the end of the world in every molecule of your body. Literally. And you are, therefore, sitting right now at the exact center of the universe. And every time you sit in meditation, this is exactly, literally the case. Every time you sit in meditation, to whatever extent you are able to let go of your worries and your concerns and just simply be present with your body and your breath in the place where you are, you are returning to the place where everything has been destroyed and nothing can ever be destroyed. And there is such a feeling of joy and well-being in that place that you get it, that there is nothing to be afraid of and nothing to worry about. You're not meditating to straighten yourself out. That's too small, you know? That's too small for you. Forget about straightening yourself out. When you sit in meditation, you are way beyond needing to be straightened out. Way beyond that. You are sitting in the middle of everything that has been destroyed and that can't be destroyed. And that gives you a tremendous sense of well-being and confidence and fearlessness. And then, of course, you've got to get up and be you. And that's a challenge. You've got to do a lot of things and figure out how to earn a living and have your friends and your life. But it's a whole different ball game, right? When you do that based on this tremendous confidence, tremendous sense of the all-rightness of things. So this, for me, is the wonderful virtue of our practice. With every breath, you know, we're literally breathing with the cosmos, right? This rhythm of coming and going that never ends, right? Never ends, is taking place inside of your body every time you breathe in and every time you breathe out. So I think sitting is the most wonderful thing. I really do. I can't get used to it all this time. I've been doing this for maybe 45 years. Can you imagine? And I don't get used to it. I don't get over how marvelous it is. And sometimes times go by, I'm running around doing this and that. I'm not sitting too much. And then I sit again. I think, oh, this is so good. This is so brilliant. Why didn't I think of that? You know, how come we never thought of that? We never thought, who would have thought? Just sit down. Just sit still. Pay attention and breathe. And your life will transform. Come on, you've got to be kidding me. Who would have thought of that? But the Buddha thought of that. So that's why I'm so happy to be here with all of you and Sims that has been dedicated to this sitting practice for how many years, and Rodney and all the other teachers who have tremendous faith in the practice and have devoted their lives to sharing it. So when we get caught up, you know, in the objective problems of our world, in that framework, that really doesn't make much sense. In that framework, it's impossible. You can't see your way out of that, right? Don't you get frustrated and feel hopeless? Because within that framework, it makes sense to be frustrated and hopeless. But we don't live actually in that framework. That's a construction of our minds. We're living in a much bigger framework if only we would recognize it. So anyway, that's what I wanted to tell you tonight. Thank you for listening. And that's why I'm so happy to be here, because whenever you're in a room full of people that are devoted to meditation practice, how can anything ever go wrong, right? Even when things go wrong, you don't care, because everything's fine. So, what time are we supposed to stop? Do we have time for a few comments, questions? Yeah. So I'm happy to discuss with you if you have anything you want to bring up. You could understand what I was saying, right? It made a certain amount of sense, I hope. I'm always frightened that it won't make sense. But it made sense, right? Good. I hope so. Mm-hmm.
Can you choose to substitute the word humility for confidence? I know it sounds like it's opposite.
you know, it doesn't seem opposite to me at all. I think that humility is confidence. If I'm confident in me, this is not going to go well, right? I can't be confident in me. I have to be confident in everything that's not me, which is humility, right? So I think, yeah, I think humility actually is a very important word to me as well. I think it's really, really important to not think that we're practicing by ourselves, for ourselves, by our own steam. The confidence that I feel is not in me, in my powers. So it is humility, exactly. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Love.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate?
Sure. Okay, so this is a condensation of thousands of pages of Mahayana Buddhist literature. Reduce it. Things arise and pass away only in one way, in connection with one another. There's no possibility that you are you without the rest of the world, without the planet Earth, without your parents, without everybody who's ever met you, without the farmers that grow the crops that feed you, and the people who build the roads you travel on and make the clothes you wear, and the sun that gives you energy and warms your... All of this, it's unimaginable. It's absolutely an impossible thing that there could be a human being without a world. Everything that arises only by one way, in concert with everything else. It actually, if you look for yourself, you don't find yourself. You only find all the things that come together in a moment. You're like a blank space that is defined by everything that comes together in that space. It comes out in a U-shaped form, right? So this means that impermanence means radical connectedness. There aren't things that are connected. There's only connectedness. And that connectedness flows on and on and on and on, and it keeps changing shape and form. It's a miracle. And that is love. So when you realize who you are, your heart is full of love. And love might not look like, it looks at all kinds of ways. Sometimes, like, you know, as we know from nature, sometimes love is a fox eating a mouse, right? So it's not, from our point of view, love can, we have a very narrow definition of love, but love really is connectivity and flow in mutuality. So for a human being, this means a feeling of love. So you feel, you look around at the world and you think, wow, what a lovely world, you know, thanks to this world, I'm here. You look at every person that you see and you think, wow, what a wonderful person, I'm not alone. I'm met by others, I can talk to them, I can understand them because they're like me. So, and that is impermanence. That's the way things actually turn. And we have a conceptual framework in which I say, I'm me, and you're you, and there's a big apple pie standing between us, and I better get my share, because if I don't grab it fast enough, you might get more than me. That's the way we live in the world. But that's not the way the world actually is. That's something our minds have imposed on the world. That help? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes?
You said something that I think came in three phrases, but as you finished the second phrase, I thought, well, how do I not write this down? So, but the first two phrases were devotion to our practice and open hearted compassion. And do you remember the sentence that followed that? Yeah, neither do I.
Yeah. Probably it's not important. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Certain economic structures, but should we be doing more? And if so,
yeah, of course we should. And but what we should do, because there's nothing but doing, right? Living is doing stuff. You don't live without doing stuff. So we're all doing stuff. And so what you should do, or I should do, or any one of us should do, going to depend on our circumstances and our situation. So there's no prescription. Everybody now should start doing this. No, because that doesn't make any sense. Somebody does what they can do from where they are. But everybody, yes, I think that part of all this is that we all have an obligation to do whatever we can do to be of benefit to others. That's what this amounts to. And not with a sense of like heavy duty, you know, like, oh, I gotta, but rather with its joyful sense that look at this world. Of course, what do I want to do? I want to go forth and exert maximum energy to be of benefit to others. So what does that mean? What does that look like? Well, for each one of us, we're going to have to figure out what our circumstances are and what can be done. What is the contribution that we can make, that we're moved from the inside to make, that our circumstances allow us to make? So yes, we have to do. Of course we do more. I wasn't suggesting that we just all, you know, sort of sit here in the road and as the world collapses. Although maybe there's a moment when that's the best thing to do. You know, it could be. But no, I think we are active. Bodhisattvas, which is the Mahayana Buddhist name for a practitioner, are always active. They're like, sometimes I say, the energizer bunnies of Buddhism. They just keep going, you know. The bodhisattvas just keep going, doing things on behalf of others, whatever they can do. Foolishly, stupidly, they just keep on going. So yeah, you should, definitely we should be doing stuff. But when you practice, when you contemplate these things that I'm talking about, at least I hope this is you can see this, it makes the activity sustainable. See, because doing a bunch of stuff without the problems of the world are pretty large. So in order to sustain endless activity forever, you have to have a perspective. Without that, you're going to become fatigued and probably act unwisely. It's possible to have good intentions and do stuff that actually makes things worse when you don't have some wisdom. So the point here is that the practice that we do gives us perspective, wisdom, and sustainability. And we need that. But I think that everything is activism. Everything. Because, like I say, there's no living without activity, and all activity is activism. So, if you are what we call in our world an activist, and I think more and more of us need to be activists, it's not right to say, I'm an activist and these other schlemiels are not. Because then you lose track of yourself, right? You forget what you're trying to do. Why would you be an activist? You care about everybody. And now you're telling everybody they're a bunch of dummies because they're not activists too. I hate you, you're not an activist. You know, that's ridiculous. No, you're an activist if you went to the toilet today, you're an activist. You did something. And there are people who that's about all they can do, you know, right? My mother-in-law is 93 years old, and she's in bed all the time. And she's an activist. She lives her life. Am I going to say, 93 years old, you're just taking up space. You're not doing anything. You're not helping anybody. Am I going to say that? If I think like that, then what am I doing, right? So everybody's an activist. Okay, does that make sense? Yeah. Good. One always aspires to make sense. But it's not guaranteed. Mm-hmm. The Book of Serenity. I think Shambhala publishes it under that title, The Book of Serenity, translated by Thomas Cleary, C-L-E-A-R-Y. That's the version I was reading from. There's another translation too, but that's the one that's standard. Because it's the only one that translates the entire commentary and stuff. Did I see another hand back there? Yeah.
Why should one strive to not suffer?
Why should one strive to not suffer? Yeah, right. Yes, that's right. So the question of suffering is more nuanced than it seems at first. Actually, we want to suffer. Bodhisattvas, practitioners, want to suffer. They want to suffer because they care about others. So the suffering that comes from caring about others, we call it suffering, but it's actually not what the Buddha meant by dukkha. Because the paradox of suffering due to caring for others is that simultaneously you're suffering and you're happy to be suffering. Because it's your love that makes you suffer. So in the case that you mentioned, grief over the loss of a loved one is something we would want to feel, even though it actually is painful. But we would choose to feel that pain because of love, right? The suffering that comes because of our own stupidity and making our lives worse when they don't have to be worse, and making other people miserable because of our selfishness and so on and so on and so on, that kind of suffering we could do without. And that's the kind of suffering that the Buddha meant when he used the word dukkha. He meant the kind of suffering that takes that which is impermanent to be permanent, and takes that which doesn't really exist to be truly existing. And therefore, we suffer because of that mistake. That's what the Buddha meant by dukkha. But caring for others and suffering on behalf of others is not the same thing. Yeah. So I think we do want to suffer more. We want to be... I was reading, I'm reading the Laudato Si. Did any of you read this? Yeah, it's the Pope's encyclical about the environment. And in there he says, the reason I'm writing this is I want you to suffer more. I want you to suffer as the planet suffers. I want you to feel it. We need to feel an emotional connection to the planet Earth, and we need to feel the Earth suffering. And that's a positive thing for us to feel. So yes, suffering is a good thing when it's altruistic suffering. Or even to suffer. If I'm going to die tomorrow and I'm sad because I'm going to die, I'm sad because I'm going to leave behind such a beautiful world. It's so nice around here, you know? I like this. Don't you like this? Nice planet. It's beautiful. I live on the ocean, as Ellen mentioned, and I look at the ocean and I'm flabbergasted by the ocean. It's so beautiful, and the mountains around here are so beautiful. And all the people are so beautiful. This is a sad thing, you know, to have to leave this. Plus, I have a lot of friends and people I practice with. So when I'm weeping for my own death, it's not really me I'm sad about, you know, it's all this beauty. So I think that's a good thing. I want to feel that. Don't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's enough for now. And we're going to have the retreat this weekend. Some of you, I hope, will come to it.